Thanks, everyone. Welcome to the final session of Saturday's Marxism 2019 conference. My name is Ben. I'll be chairing the session. You are in Karl Korsch, Marxism and Philosophy. Our speaker tonight is Darren, and I'm going to hand it over to him straight away.
Thank you very much. I'm going to sit down for the talk because I'm already elevated. Okay, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that Karl Korsch is the most neglected and forgotten Marxist that has graced the history of Marxism. Such neglect is more a result of what E.P. Thompson has called the condescension of posterity than it has to do with the weaknesses of Korsch's own contribution to revolutionary Marxism. In the English-speaking world today, most activists have a vague idea of his life and work. They recognise that he wrote an important book called Marxism and Philosophy, but then worry that he became an ultra-leftist and an anti-Leninist, and without Trotsky's stamp of approval, it was unclear whether he was a legitimate person to read or take seriously or not. Others from the Anglophone New Left read him during the phase of upsurge, of struggle and hope, and then put him down just as quickly. Yet Korsch was one of the clearest Marxists to have worked in Germany from the defeat of the November Revolution to the Nazi seizure of power, after which he was forced into exile and continued to fight for theoretical clarity and truth. Korsch got many of the most important political and theoretical questions of his time right because he had an unwavering commitment to human freedom. In the early KPD, the German Communist Party, he played a leading role of interpreting and propagating Marx's ideas. Before writing Marxism and Philosophy in 1923, he published An Introduction to Marx's Goethe Program and the Core Points of the Materialist Conception of History. And in the early period of the KPD, it was far from being a monolithic bloc, and between the period of 1918 and 1923, it had no universally accepted Marxist theoretical framework or philosophical foundation. Philosophies of life, even positivist approaches to Marxism, coexisted in different forms alongside Marxist conceptions. But even the Marxist theory and conceptions themselves were up for grabs. Many other socialists and communists of his time also shared this commitment to socialism from below and the commitment to freedom. So what made Korsch's contribution to Marxism so special? Firstly, he was a theorist of the workers' councils movements in Germany during the revolution, and more than that, he was able to provide a political account of the rise and defeat of these workers' councils movements in the revolutionary process. He fought for a revolutionary interpretation of Marx, firstly against Kautsky's reformist tradition in the German labour movement, and then against the long-standing leaders of the Communist Party, like Hermann Duncker and August Thalheimer, and finally against the Stalinist apparatchiks. We often forget that the split within the German labour movement after the war led to a debate over who actually inherited Marx's legacy, and so there was a divide over what it actually meant to restore Marxist theory and politics. In close connection to the debate over who inherited Marx's legacy, Korsch developed the most sustained theoretical and systematic critique of reformist ideology and practices within the German labour movement. These debates are still relevant today, and the systematic theoretical critiques of reformism remain crucial to going beyond the facile psychological accounts of political failure which are making their return. Korsch set out the parameters towards an understanding of the relationship of Marxism and philosophy, a question that is just as important as the relationship of Marxism to the state. He therefore carried out an imminent critique of the Marxism of his time, and demonstrated that without an adequate appreciation of the relationship between consciousness and reality, no successful workers' revolution is possible. Without the coincidence of consciousness and reality, a critique of political economy could never have become a major component of a theory of social revolution. Korsch's essay, Marxism and Philosophy, was a foundational document for the subsequent generation of Frankfurt School critical theory. And Korsch was the first to apply the Marxist conception of history to the history of Marxism itself, with a specific intent to show when and where Marxist theory advanced or regressed in relationship to the class struggle, and where it functioned ideologically in this movement. This was a break with the traditional understanding of the relationship between theory and the class struggle, as penned by Rosa Luxemburg, who, in her article on the stagnation and progress in Marxism, basically thought that Marxist theory was a great reserve that is simply reactivated as the class struggle progressively unfolds in history. This was the dominant understanding of Marxist theory of her time, and Korsch, on the contrary, argued that there was a structural tension between Marxist theory and the class struggle itself, and therefore rejected the idea that there was some kind of inherent harmony or pre-established identity between Marxist theory and the development of class struggle. In political terms, Korsch supported the merger between the United Independent Socialist Party with the Communists, and then he supported the United Front tactic until the aborted October uprising of 1923. This is very important because the support for the United Front tactic was a political precondition for what he wrote in Marxism and Philosophy. This changed after the aborted October uprising, and he had adopted some more leftist positions, which on social fascism, which are very bad, during his time in Berlin in the mid-20s. But he shifted away from these positions. Korsch was the earliest critic of the rise of Stalinism in Russia and its destructive effects in the German Communist Party. He was expelled for his anti-Stalinist opposition in 1926, but he did not give up his commitment to the self-emancipation of the working class. The period after his expulsion, though difficult to the extreme, were some of the most productive of his most productive years, theoretically. In this period, he reformed his ideas and he dissented from the Stalinist dogmatization of Marxist theory, better known as the transformation of Marxism into a state ideology justifying the oppression of workers. Korsch understood that the USSR was a state capitalist regime fundamentally antagonistic to to working class self-emancipation by the mid to the late 1920s, at a time when Trotsky did not. Because he understood the nature of the Stalinist regime, he argued that any attempt to reform the state capitalist regime was doomed not only to fail, but also to capitulate to elements of Stalinism because of the inherent instability of these positions. Korsch maintained a consistent criticism of abstract ultra-leftist politics. He was not an ultra-left, and this label began, in fact, with Stalin and was used to attack anybody critical of Stalin's totalitarian rule. Korsch consistently criticized other currents on the left who either refused parliamentary participation in principle or refused trade union work in principle. Korsch was also a critic of the Popular Front politics during the Spanish Civil War and during World War II, while he was in exile in America. Korsch recognized in Lenin, the leader of the October Revolution, a practitioner of an undogmatic guide for Marxist theory and revolutionary politics, and because of this, he broke with the ideology of Leninism, which had become an ideological fetter upon the new developments of class struggle of his time. Korsch argued, and he was correct to do so, that the attempt to restore some kind of authentic Leninism was a reactionary illusion, and this was consistent with his critique of Stalinism. Last but not least, and I should mention the themes he raised for Marxist theory, obviously, given it's in the theory stream, some of which will be key to this talk, and I apologise if it's just a barrage of concepts and ideas. Korsch re-praised the place of Hegel in Marx's theory, the German philosopher who influenced Marx so deeply. He reappraised the question of commodity fetishism and its theoretical role in capital and the value form. Korsch raised the problem of the specificity of Marx's materialism and its relationship to the differences, the structural differences, between the bourgeois revolutions and the content of workers' revolutions. And Korsch, lastly, developed on Marx's notion of critique, which was a forgotten but fundamental aspect of Marx's theory and politics. Korsch, however, unfortunately, was weakest on theories of economic crisis. But I'd like to say a few words about how we understand the so-called Western Marxist tradition that Korsch seems to fit into. The classic text is Perry Anderson's Considerations on Western Marxism, more or less, which remains a standard reference point for those interested in the history of Marxist theory. In his book, he argues that Western Marxism was a reaction to the defeat of the Russian Revolution, and it involved a flight from active involvement in the class struggle to a preoccupation with philosophy to the detriment of a critique of political economy, in a way that the classical Marxists would have rejected. Anderson's argument is selective, and in the case of Karl Korsch, fails to hold any water. It was an important move on Anderson's behalf to identify Western Marxism as an alternative to the dominant trends of Second International and Stalinized Marxism, but the very notion of a Western Marxism itself was quite old and took shape in the early 1920s, when Korsch penned his anti-critique, his defense of Marxism and philosophy. There are two reasons to question Perry Anderson's thesis. Well, firstly, one argument pertains to Korsch and the other to the histories of Marxist theory in general. And I'll start with the latter argument. When Anderson lamented the displacement from the critique of political economy to philosophical or indeed methodological questions, he did so in a far too defensive manner. Not only was Anderson empirically wrong in many instances, he simply saw the philosophical element as a symptom of retreat, not of attempts towards reorientation, theoretical reorientation against Stalinist Marxism. This meant he disregarded the role questions of method, which are nothing other than interrogations into the character of Marxist theory itself and the role these had in the political confrontations of the time. And this completely underestimated the importance of such theoretical interventions and their political character in opposition to the reliance on an oversimplified form of Marxist ideology within the Social Democratic Party and the Stalinized Communist Party. In the case of Karl Korsch, he fails to actually grasp what he actually was. Korsch was excluded from academia from 1924 onwards because of his revolutionary politics. Therefore, he was not a professional philosopher and should not be characterized as such. And he did not rise up through academic institutions. Rather, he was a downwardly mobile intellectual. He continued to write for the workers' movement. And this was the case after his exile from the German Communist Party and the exile years after Hitler came to power. And he did not develop an esoteric diction or style. There is no movement away from the critique of political economy towards philosophical abstraction in his work. And though Korsch does orient to questions of method, he does so in relation to the critique of political economy. Though the exile and war years had a profoundly negative impact on Korsch's thinking, which took a great toll on his thought, he continued to write concretely about the world around him. Lastly, Perry Anderson entirely neglected Korsch's book Karl Marx, which was published in 1938, which was a very important book at the time for figures like Walter Benjamin and even Bertolt Brecht. And this was, if you wish, a synthesis of all the years of political confrontation and theoretical research into Marx's work in opposition to the dogmatization of Marxism in the 1930s. So it was an important work. And Perry Anderson left it out. But anyway, I'm going to move on to Marxism and philosophy for the rest of the talk, which is what it's based on. So published in 1923, and by the way, I'm going to focus on the theoretical aspects of it, not so much the biographical or political aspects of Korsch's thinking from here on out. But feel free to ask questions about it in the discussion because it is very important. In Marxism and philosophy, Korsch made an argument that until then had not been uttered by anyone in the German labour movement. He stated the case for an application of the materialist conception of history to the materialist conception of history itself. This argument is much more than an intellectual history of Marxist theory, and it is quite distinct from a purely social history of the workers' movement of the 19th and early 20th centuries. To argue for the application of the materialist conception of history to the materialist conception of history itself was a specific way of criticizing the existing Marxisms of his time. It was an imminent critique that critically considers the connection between the historical forms of praxis within the German SPD and so on, and the theoretical formations that Marxism took within these historical forms of practice. This is a very important question, I think. So what does this mean exactly? It meant to grasp the genesis and the history of Marx's method from Marx and Engels to the late writings, and the Second International, and into the present. Korsch meticulously followed the development of Marx and Engels' theory, as well as the development, its development in the Second International, because at the time he believed that a new phase of Marxist theory was opening up with a successful revolution in Russia. And it was time to settle accounts with the dominant ideology and orthodoxy of the Second International. His argument was an undogmatic and anti-dogmatic, historical and critical materialist view of Marx's theory, and its task is to discern the different phases of development through which Marxism itself had passed from its original conception in the 1840s to the present. In Korsch's time, Marxism had already split into different historical versions. Between the Social Democrats, the Communists, and the ultra-lefts, how did these different historical forms of Marxism and the different phases through which they passed relate to one another? We have to cast our mind back to the outbreak of World War I and the crisis in the Second International when the German Social Democrats supported the war effort. Korsch called this a crisis of Marxism, because it led to several tendencies, each of which invoked Marx and fought each other for the right to claim the heritage of the one true form of Marxism. Kautsky and social democrats argued they maintained their direct line to Marx, and they were in a way sincere about this, but deluded also, and this influenced the way they read Marx. Orthodox communists pointed out that they were the true and authentic inheritors of Marx's work against the Social Democrats. The crisis of Marxism and the split into different camps provided to be a stubborn and persistent conflict. As late as August 1929, well after the defeated German Revolution, writers were still penning the argument that Karl Kautsky's book, The Materialist Conception of History, was the beginning of a restoration of genuine and authentic Marxism, and they genuinely believed it. Korsch saw that the crisis of Marxism couldn't be resolved dogmatically. The dogmatic attitude to Marxism is a form of Neoplatonism. Marxism is treated as a timeless, absolute, unchangeable idea that somehow remains like a pure form beyond the transformations of history. To be a Marxist is then to have a privileged access to this timeless, absolute, and unchanging idea, against which everything else is a deviation from this ideal norm, or, in other words, a heresy. Behind the discourse of deviation, both of the orthodox Marxists of his time and the Social Democrats, in fact, lay a latent idealism, a theoretical backwardness, and its common foundation, as Korsch pointed out, lay in the fact that Marxism had ceased to be a living theory, but had become an ideology to legitimize bureaucratic forms of power, whether the operations of the Social Democratic Party itself or the Bolshevizing Russian regime from the mid-1920s onwards. What made Korsch's Marxism and philosophy so exciting and pathbreaking was its attempt to settle accounts with the most stunting features of past forms of Marxism that had become fetters upon the further development of the class struggle. Yet it was also tragic, because as soon as the book was published, the most stunting features were solidifying themselves in the name of Stalinism, and they would soon chase him from the party. Well, while it is always useful to reconstruct Marx's own arguments, history after him cannot be treated as a tale of stupidity, deviation, and error in the name of some authentic and ideal substance. For Korsch, and I'm quoting him here, he says, "Dogmatic calculations of how far the different versions of Marx's theory correspond to some abstract canon of pure and unfalsified theory should be abandoned. This was not a popular argument at the time, but I believe it was the only consistently materialist orientation available to Marxists then and now, because it emphasizes the crucial role of history's development, in the face of which all variants of theoretical fetishism break down. Judged from a different angle, Korsch was predisposed to making this argument for the simple reason that his intellectual formation was classically bourgeois before his turn to Marx in 1920. He turned to Marx's theory just as the workers' councils were defeated. Korsch had been steeped in the neo-Kantian debates of his time, where they emphasised the problems of form and content, which are fundamental to understanding the relationship between Hegel and Marx. And Korsch was also a close reader of the human sciences and of the school associated with Wilhelm Dilthey, who was an important figure in Germany. Very much like George Lukács and Antonio Gramsci, Korsch looked at Marx through the lens of his early theoretical formation. It was simply a fact that this new generation of theorists wrote most incisively on Marx and did so owing to this rich intellectual tradition. Intellectuals with a bourgeois training like this often brought something innovative to Marxism. This is a fact of the labour movement. In the Second International, for instance, Antonio Labriola and Franz Mehring both shared a bourgeois training. Labriola's essays on the materialist conception of history, for instance, and his letters to Sorel remain classics. Labriola was a member of the Naples Hegelian circles when Hegelian thought was flourishing in Italy. As for Franz Mehring, the first to have written a systematic and partisan biography of Karl Marx, he initially started his literary career as an opponent of the Social Democratic Party. And when he first began writing for Die Neue Zeit, the SPD's theoretical journal, Kautsky did not trust him because of this past. Yet as things turned out, Mehring remained a consistent supporter of the revolutionary left until he died, and he raised polemics within the socialist movement to an art form. But the new intellectuals like Korsch and Lukács were bound to clash with the old guard of the communist movement, who held on to their pre-war dogmas, and were susceptible, even before the Stalinist rot set in, to the charge that they had somehow deviated from Marxism. As soon as Marxism and Philosophy was published, it faced stern resistance among the communist and social democratic wings of the labour movement. Here is what Korsch had to say about the response to his essay. The authoritative members of the two dominant tendencies of contemporary official Marxism sensed at once, with an unerring instinct, that this unassuming little book contained a heretical rejection of certain dogmas. Despite all their apparent disagreements, the two confessions of the old Marxist Orthodox Church still held these in common. They were therefore quick to denounce the book before their assembled councils for containing views that were a deviation from accepted doctrine. Korsch's essay was presented in May 1923 at the first Marxist Study Week, being a straightforward exposition of the ties between, as the title suggests, Marxism and philosophy, both in their positive and negative interactions. Korsch had organised the Marxist Study Week alongside Felix Weil, and drew in George Lukács and many other figures from the Communist Party. Lukács had just published History and Class Consciousness. Both Korsch and Lukács were tasked with introducing the discussions on Marx's method and the dialectic. Karl Wittfogel, who participated in the event and was a member of the Communist Party, wrote that Korsch and Lukács both played a leading part in the Marxist Study Week, and they focused on the meaning of the dialectic for revolutionary praxis, which, in their opinion, had been neglected by most orthodox Marxists. In other words, most orthodox Marxists of the time had all become Feuerbachians once again. That is, they argued for some form of naturalist materialism that Marx had already broken with. From the standpoint of philosophy, the first Marxist study week was one of the most important intellectual events to have ever taken place in the history of Marxism. Every future intervention into Marxist philosophy throughout the 20th century either positively developed upon or was compelled to critically respond to Korsch and Lukács and the work they presented at this event. The Marxist Study Week was intended to restore Marxian philosophy against the traditions of the Second International, and it was analogous to the political restoration that took place in Lenin's State and Revolution, and then Henrik Grossman's subsequent restoration of economics with his writings on crisis theory. Because the Marxist Study Week was held in May 1923, political hopes for the German Revolution were still running high, and cautious theoretical arguments themselves were situated within a support for the United Front policy within the KPD. Korsch thought that a new phase of Marxist theory was opening, able to settle accounts, as I said, with the Kautskyan ideology once and for all, and that this new phase would be reinforced by a successful workers' revolution in the West, Germany in particular. And Korsch's wager was that the Marxist theorists of the pre-war period were wrong to regard philosophical, epistemological, and methodological questions as at most an utter waste of time and effort. While these theorists allowed discussion of philosophical issues, they were quite clear that the clarification of philosophical problems was totally irrelevant to the practice of working class struggle, and would always remain so. If you look through the pages in Neue Zeit, the SPD's journal, you'll find that there was discussion of philosophy. Franz Mehring wrote a great deal about the Neo-Kantians and about Fichte, for instance, who was a contemporary of Hegel's. Even though there was discussion about philosophy, there was no clarity about the relationship of Marxism to philosophy. This was the problem, the inaugural problem of Korsch's essay. This orthodox attitude to philosophy rested upon a false premise. They took Marxist theory and practice to be unchanging and fixed, and this unchanging theory had no supposed position on any philosophical question whatsoever. And in fact, it lacked a philosophical content. They genuinely believed that Marxist science had exercised philosophical questions from Marxism for good. They forgot that philosophical practice takes new shapes and forms even after Marx had settled his accounts with his former philosophical conscience in 1845. Korsch's own starting point had two elements. First, Marxist theory was a new materialism, simultaneously a rupture with naturalist, materialist forms of bourgeois thought, as well as idealism in its Hegelian form. And Marxist theory itself was subject to the historical conditions placed upon it by the class struggle itself. That is, it was not a static theory, but a theory that experienced change in relationship to the class struggle. Korsch argued that Marx's materialist conception of history was a breakthrough. And the breakthrough was of a specific order. It established a new set of conditions of possibility to think the very problem of philosophy itself. It was a point of no return in the history of social and political thought and philosophical thought. This had deep and thoroughgoing implications for the history of philosophy as well as the philosophies of history, which made Marxist theory able to go beyond and solve the very problems of bourgeois thought itself. You have to remember that in Germany at the time, there was nothing new about wanting to treat history scientifically. In fact, the attempt to treat history scientifically, which took shape in the tradition known as historicism, had a very, very long history from Schleidenius in the German Vico, writing in the early 18th century through Erder and Ranke up until Korsch's own contemporaries. That spans a whole period from pre to post French Revolution, after Bismarck's restoration, national unification of the country. Pre-Marxist historical thinking was very sophisticated in Germany. The concept of history itself experienced profound transformations during and after the French Revolution. These conceptual transformations had two principal features. Firstly, world history was transformed into a process that moved essentially in time. And the second was that history was described as an essentially immanent or internal rather than external development. You had no God that propelled history forward. Because of these conceptual changes, history was not a purely empirical problem, but one related to theory and concepts. You cannot think about history without a concept of process that has an immanent logic. But you also cannot think about history without really existing material and empirical social relations that make up this very history. This caused a major problem for the bourgeois writers of the history of philosophy. For instance, the bourgeois writers of Cauchy's time were imprisoned within the impasse between a purely empirical method, represented by the historical school at that time, and an abstract method. Within bourgeois thought itself, the most important representative to have spotted this impasse and tried to resolve it was Wilhelm Dilthey, who tried to provide a philosophical foundation for the historical sciences, able to transcend the divide between empiricism and abstract theory. Marx represented a breakthrough in terms of historical thought, and it is perhaps a paradox that the battle over historical method launched in Germany with the publication of Dilthey's Introduction to the Human Sciences kicked off at the same year as Marx's death. Cauchy was well aware of the limitations of bourgeois thought and saw in Marx's theory a resolution to them. If I were to capture the whole idea of Marxism and philosophy in one sentence, I'd say that Cauchy wanted to demonstrate that Marx's materialist dialectic is a theoretical comprehension of history within which the abstract divide between historical and theoretical material no longer applies, i.e. it resolves the problems that the bourgeois thinkers remained imprisoned within. I don't think you can understand the significance of Cauchy's argument, but neither of those of Lukács or Gramsci, if you don't take into consideration why and how they saw Marx's theory to be a resolution of these really existing bourgeois contradictions. In the communist movement itself, these bourgeois contradictions were alive and well. As a consequence, these bourgeois theoretical impasses were reproduced within the communist movement that called itself revolutionary. Bukharin had tried to formulate a general sociology, a mechanical materialism, as did Karl Wittfogel, who was a friend of Cauchy's in Germany. Cauchy recognized that if Marxist theory cannot solve the impasses of bourgeois thought itself, it may fail to be revolutionary. This is a lesson we can draw from writers or authors like Lukács, Gramsci, and Cauchy. They carried out an imminent critique of the most advanced forms of intellectual practice of their time to pull apart and tease out their inherent contradictions in order to give a clearer and more accurate explanatory account of what Marxist theory actually is. You can't imagine Gramsci without Benedetto Croce, Lukács without Weber, Simmel, or Lask, nor Cauchy without Richard Lasp or Wilhelm Dilthey. The more their work is investigated, the clearer the role of these non-Marxist thinkers becomes, as well as the conflicts between the Marxian and non-Marxian arguments. This is why Cauchy argued to treat philosophies as concrete realities. They are ideal components of the objective world and therefore have a truth. They must be theoretically understood and deconstructed and practically overthrown, hence the importance of Marx's statement that philosophy cannot be abolished without being realized. The task to treat philosophies as concrete realities was all the more urgent since, in the case of the vulgar and centrist Marxism, the so-called bourgeois philosophers were ahead of them. Many had long ago given up. Many of the neo-Kantian philosophers, for instance, that influenced Cauchy, had long ago given up the mechanical separation between consciousness and reality. Cauchy's whole essay begins with the epigraph dedicated to Lenin's argument to read Hegel materialistically. Lenin's statement immediately raised the relationship between Hegel and Marx, the so-called transition from idealism to materialism. The common idea at the time was that everything in Hegel was simply rotated from its idealist form to a materialist form, from an idealist spirit to a materialist matter. Yet Cauchy did not think that this was the key question. He polemicized against those Marxist theorists who believed it was the key question, and Cauchy's argument was specific in favor of a Marxist new materialism that overcame all the problems of Hegelian thought in both form and content. According to Quash, the crude idea of a transition from an idealist spirit and Hegelian spirit to a materialist matter was inadequate because it failed to appreciate what he called Marx's Aufhebung of the form and content of classical philosophy. The German word Aufhebung is special and cannot be translated into one English word because it simultaneously refers to an abolition, preservation, and overcoming. Hegelian philosophy was abolished, yet something of it was preserved while being overcome by the new Marxian standpoint. Korsch's investigation of the way Marx's theory abolished, preserved, and overcame philosophy was the beginning of a very long process of such questioning. Korsch stressed that the relationship between Hegel and Marx could not be understood with reference to could only be understood, sorry, with reference to Marx's own concrete theoretical practice in Capital primarily. For Korsch, these questions were important because it was a way to resolve or think through and resolve the relationship between ideology and social revolution against the impasses of Second International Marxism. Without resolving the relationship of ideology and social revolution, it is impossible to conceive of a rupture or an overthrow of capitalism. If you have no idea or conceptual means to understand how a mass of collective subject or workers can become political and revolutionary in history and the ideological mediations involved in this process, you cannot really think about revolutionary transformation and the overthrow of the existing order. Korsch's essay in this sense was analogous to Lenin's State and Revolution, and he was clear about this, as both argued for a theoretical restoration of an essential component of Marx's work to meet the needs of a revolutionary present. But there was a crucial difference between Lenin's book and Korsch's, and Korsch was conscious of this difference. Any attempt to restore what Marx regarded as the only scientific dialectical materialist conception and treatment of ideological realities inevitably encounters even greater theoretical obstacles than an attempt to restore the correct Marxist theory of the state. Earlier, I had said that philosophy was as important as the state, or to understand it. This may seem overblown, but I don't mean by this that philosophers make history, or that the question of the state, the question of the state cannot be practically solved without ideology having been settled in and solved in both theory and practice. Does anyone actually think that the relationship between ideology and social revolution has been resolved theoretically, let alone practically? No, no doubt it has been resolved, not yet in practice in the West, but even in theory, the resolution remains to be found. And this is the debate, I think, that Korsch tried to open up in his essay. Marx made two theoretical moves that were decisive for the history of philosophy and the relation of ideas to social revolution. On the one hand, Marx introduced the concept of ideology into an understanding of philosophy, or the philosophers. Such a use of ideology was historically unprecedented, and this is what gives the German ideology that Marx wrote such a great force. For Korsch, it was very important to investigate just how Marx and Engels were led to the question of ideology in the first place. They were led there by way of another question: how was philosophy related to the social revolution of the working class, and how is the social revolution of the working class related to philosophy and ideas? Remember that Marx saw the working class as a universal and revolutionary subject before he came to terms with ideology. On the other hand, Marx introduced a critique of the fetish character of commodity production. Korsch argued, correctly, that the critique of commodity fetishism inaugurates a new epoch in the development of social thought. And let me quote Korsch from his later work, Karl Marx. Marx was the first to represent the fundamental character of the bourgeois mode of production as the particular historical stage of material production whose characteristic social form is reflected reversely in a fetishistic manner, both in the practical concepts of the ordinary man of business and in the scientific reflection of that normal bourgeois consciousness, political economy. Thus, the theoretical exposure of the fetish character of the commodity and its secret is not only the kernel of the Marxian critique of political economy, but at the same time, the quintessence of the economic theory of capital and the most explicit and most exact definition of the theoretical and historical standpoint of the whole materialistic science of society. Second International Marxism failed to appreciate the way Marx's two moves with respect to the problem of ideology and fetishism abolished, preserved, and overcame the traditional problems of philosophy, most importantly, the classical German philosophy of Kant and Hegel. In fact, the orthodox Marxists and bourgeois philosophers in Germany, writing after the wave of revolutions in 1848, failed to see how the classical problems of Kant and Hegel passed over into the hands of the new theoretical representatives of the workers' movement, i.e. Marx and Engels, and the tradition that inherited their work. Korsch saw in classical German philosophy a philosophical revolution that coincided with the revolutionary, then restorative, movement of the bourgeoisie of the French Revolution. The Germans thought what the French did in practice, a point that Hegel made repeatedly, and Hegel understood that philosophy's relationship to reality, Hegel had understood philosophy's relationship to reality, and Marx salvaged this fundamental insight. Hegel argued that philosophy was its own time comprehended in thought, and Hegel's fundamental insight passed over into Marx's notion of ideology and fetishism, but also of the relationship of theory to the class struggle. Before Korsch and Lukács intervened into Marx's theory, there was no coherent theoretical account of ideology and fetishism, and consequently no coherent account of the way a majority of workers could rise from conditions of domination to overthrow capitalism and its state. Different authors may have arrived at fragmentary insights into fetishism and ideology, but they never systematized these into a coherent account of Marx's theory, and political practice alone cannot solve the theoretical questions Korsch raised. That the theoretical plane must be taken seriously was one of Korsch's take-home points in the essay. He demonstrated convincingly, I think, that there is a dualism between theoreticism, if you wish, the idea that pure speculative theory solves the problems of reality, and he also polemicized against pragmatism, the idea that, you know, pragmatic political practice of the moment is enough to overthrow the structures of capitalist domination. Korsch was looking for a resolution to this dualism. He found the resolution in Marx's New Materialism, as penned in the thesis on Feuerbach. It is important to be careful here. It is easy to read into Marx's 11th thesis on Feuerbach, a liquidation of philosophy into pragmatic politics, but this is not what Korsch meant. Korsch's theoretical argument essentially boiled down to say that there was a relationship between consciousness and reality, i.e. consciousness and reality within capitalist society coincide. And this is an argument the vulgar Marxists rejected. It was the sore point of his essay and became so in the receptions of the book in the 20s. If you reject Korsch's idea that consciousness and reality exist in a dialectical relationship, you are compelled to say that ideas are over here, settled in their own continent, and that reality is over there, far off and separated from the continent of ideas. You will never find the necessary mediations that link forms of social consciousness to the structures of capitalist society. You will be forever lost in the deep blue sea of your own filling in search of the elusive passage from the continent of structures to the continent of the ideal, forms, because you have just separated these consonants violently and cannot find the concrete and historical mediations between ideas and reality. Caution. I've got a lot more to go, but I have to stop soon. So Korsch drew the conclusions that the material relations of capitalist production are only what they are in combination with the forms in which they are reflected in pre-scientific and bourgeois scientific consciousness, and they could not subsist in reality without these forms of consciousness. You can't think of the material structures of capitalist society, oppression in the workplace, so on and so forth, without also thinking about the relation, the ideas that bolster this very materially existing system. As a result of Korsch's argument that ideas and reality coincide, it was possible that Marx's critique of political economy could become a major component of a theory of social revolution. And this is an essential point, I think. This conclusion is not available to the centrist Marxists, let alone the revisionist Marxists or the vulgar Marxists, who all abstractly and mechanically separate ideas and reality. So Korsch and his essay, it is basically a grand attack on reformist Marxist theoreticians of his time, and these ideas of, you know, the ideas of Kautsky, for instance, before and during the German Revolution, and then the Stalinist ideas that formulated in the mid-1920s onwards, that turn Marxist theory into a science that legitimizes a state that oppresses workers. Both of these camps in the labor movement could not grasp the essential argument Korsch was making, and they denounced him for that. But actually, I'll leave it there, because I've gone over time.